consider it something enjoyable. All right, so we are holding by the two dots about the middle of Nuntah, a little past the middle of Nuntah Summer Days. So we learned in a Braisa, we were discussing yesterday in a Braisa and the Gemara on it, the simonim of Chayit Taharis, which we said it's not so much to know whether they're kosher or not, because for those, they're the same simonim as behemoth, but rather to see whether you're allowed to eat their chayim. So we talked about various simonim of different details in the way their horns are shaped or whatever, as well as their hooves. We mentioned in that connection the Braisa said the keresh, afal pi shein lekerenachas, a keresh, even though it only has one horn, mutter, is mutter to eat. And we discussed yesterday what a keresh is. One possibility is Sichas Cholin mentions based on the idea about the one horn as well as something else that the Gemara is going to say in a minute, that maybe it's a giraffe. Anyway, Almud of Yehuda. So Rav Yehuda says it's a kosher animal. It's got to choose its good, well, pastures. I mean, it chooses to cut. It has split hooves. I mean, it does have split hooves. If you go with now remember, we did mention yesterday, the Shach says this thing about needing a masoda for chayas. And we discussed, does it mean that you need a masoda in order to eat the chaylev, or do you need a masoda to eat them, period? If you say it means a masoda to eat them, period, then maybe not, because we don't necessarily have a masoda on giraffes.
But it's very kosher.
Right. In fact, the Rav Sadia Goin translates when you have the list of seven chayas taharis in Parshas Re'eh, the last one is the Zemer. Rav Sadia Goin translates it as a giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway. So maybe that's enough for it to be considered a masoda. I don't know. Anyway, okay. Almud of Yehuda. So Rav Yehuda says in this connection, what is a keresh? Tavya de Beiloi. A keresh is the deer of Beiloi. Well, deer, okay, we learned yesterday, actually, tavya is the same word as tzvi in Hebrew. We said yesterday, Rashi says maybe it's not a deer. Rashi had said maybe it's a mountain goat. We talked about Tosfos says it is a deer, and then maybe it's actually an ibex, whatever, not an ibex, a gazelle, whatever. Anyway, the keresh is the deer or whatever of Beiloi. But Pashas Beiloi is the name of a place. It means the higher place. So there's some kind of large species of deer there. That's the keresh. Tigris is Auya de Beiloi, and the Tigris, the Pashtus, it means the tiger, sounds like it means the tiger, yeah, is Auya de Beiloi, is the lion of Beiloi. And Rashi says, where else do we have it? The Keresh we just had. We have the Braisa, so we need to identify what it is. Where do you have any place where it talks about the Tigris? Rashi, that we should have to define it. Rashi says, I don't know where it's talked about. Okay.
Anywhere
where it says the word Tigris, that we should have to, anywhere that we, in Mishnah, Gemara, Midrashim, any of the literature of Chazal, that it says Tigris, Rashi says, I don't know where it's mentioned. Okay. Anyway.
So it's not mentioned in...
Rashi says he doesn't know of any place, so he doesn't understand why Rabbi Horda would have to define Tigris for us if we don't have it mentioned anyplace else. But whatever it is, he's defining it as Auya de Beiloi, the lion of Beiloi. And it could be maybe Taka means a tiger. Anyway,
Beiloi, we don't know
what Beiloi, whatever it's in. Amr of Kahana, so the Kahana says, let's talk about the sizes of these animals. Tesha amhosa have been una la una de Auya de Beiloi. There are 9 amas between one ear and the other of the Auya de Beiloi. So the Pashtus, una means an ear, which is usually what the meaning of it in Aramaic. So in that case, it would mean that the distance between one ear and the other of the animal is 9 amas. So in that case, it could be a particularly large species of tiger. I mean, there used to be larger species. It could be.
That's huge.
Okay, so maybe so if it's not, it's not the kind of tigers that we have, 9 amas would be like 13 feet. It would be more than that. It would be like 13 or 14 feet. Okay, anyway. Actually, there's one of the Mephoshim on the Gemara, Tiferes Yaakov, I think it is, says una can also mean the lobes of the lungs, like we learned earlier in the Perek. So maybe actually what it means is the size of the lungs is that large, in which case the Gemara is going to mention soon how loud a roar it has. If it has very large lungs, that might explain it. Anyway. Okay, anyway. Tesha amhosa have been una la una da auya de beiloi. The auya de beiloi, there's 9 amas between one ear and the other. I mean, I was going to say soon, that's a very fearsome animal. So again, it's not necessarily the kind of tigers that we see in zoos nowadays, but it could be some extra large specimen or whatever. But Omer of Yosef, Shitzer amhosa have mashke de tavya de beiloi. The length of the tavya de beiloi is 16 amos, which is another reason, by the way, why Sichas Cholin says that maybe the keresh, which we're saying is the tavya de beiloi, maybe it's a giraffe. A giraffe, indeed, is a fairly tall animal. You could say that the total length of it from the top of the head to the tail is something approximating 16 amos. Okay. I've seen other explanations on it also. As usual, Gemaras like this very often have symbolic meanings as well. In particular, I saw one explanation that somebody wants to relate the 9 amos and the 16 amos to the size of the curtains of the Mishkan, which had various kinds of animals, kruvim type shapes woven on them. So maybe it's hinting at that. Another idea. Maybe it is. I don't know. And also another idea that's brought. There was somebody who was the Rav of Hoboken back in the 1920s and 30s. Chaim Hirschenson, his name was. He published an interesting sefer on with various explanations of odd agabtes like this. And he says that maybe the Aryeh DeBeiloi and the Tavshi DeBeiloi are coded references to various superpowers of that time. For example, he says the Aryeh DeBeiloi might be the Persian Empire, which, as we know, was the rival of the Roman Empire, and that brings us actually to the next piece of Gemara over here about it. Anyway, so therefore, so 9 amos and 16 amos might be symbolic of various aspects of their power. Anyway, Amalei Keser Rabbi Yishua ben Hanania. So in that connection, speaking of the Aryeh DeBeiloi, the Keser, the Roman emperor, one time says to Rabbi Yishua ben Hanania, we know from many places in Shas and Midrashim that the emperor, Bepashas of Hadrian, used to often have conversations and discussions with Rabbi Yishua. So he says to Rabbi Yishua,
more tolerant, Adrian.
Well, so actually, the historian Rabbi Isaac Halevi in Deresh Hashanim thinks that maybe most, if not all of these, may have happened before Hadrian actually became emperor, when he was governor of Syria and whatever various posts like that in the Roman Empire. So yeah, when he was emperor, actually, it seems he started out being tolerant to the Jews, but then very quickly he changed. In particular, he was a great lover of Greek culture, and the Greeks in those times were always very anti-Semitic, so they may have had a bad influence on him, whatever. Anyway, so he says to Rabbi Yishua ben Hanania, Elokeichem ka'aryeh mosel. I know that your Hashem is compared to a lion in Tanakh. This is because you have a pasuk, for example, Aryeh shog mi lo yira, when a lion roars, who isn't afraid? And the same thing. In other words, when Hashem is giving nevuah, as the pasuk continues, then everybody's gonna feel it. So the question is, Ma'ir Abuse. So the emperor says, so what's the big deal about a lion? Parasha kotel Aryeh. A person mounted on a soldier mounted on a horse can kill a lion. Which also the various Meforshim, Marsha talks about, Maral talks about somewhat differently, that also behind this question was basically that the emperor is claiming, okay, so of course you're saying Hashem is powerful, but is he the ultimate power? Not necessarily. Just like a lion is not the ultimate power in the world, so also he's claiming the Chas v'Shalom the same about Hashem. Of course, yeah. Okay, Amarle, so Rabbi Yeshua tells him, Lav Kahai Aryeh Mosel. When we talk about that Hashem is compared to a lion, we don't mean a regular lion, the kind you would find in a zoo or whatever. Aryeh DeBeiloi Mosel. Rather, we're comparing, the pasuk is comparing Hashem to this Aryeh DeBeiloi, this extra large specimen that we just talked about. Hold on. Amarle, wait. Amarle, so the emperor says to him, Ba'ina demechsis le niele. Okay, Aryeh DeBeiloi, I want to see such a creature that you're claiming that's a valid comparison to Hashem. Amarle le motzis chazis le. So he sure tells him, you're not going to be able to see it. You're not going to be able to stand it. Amarle, so the emperor says, Tafluk ivra. Nevertheless, or indeed, chazina le, I'm going to see it. I'm in charge over here, and I order you to bring it. Barachmi, so Rabbi Yeshua Davins for Davins Hashem, is Akam Meduchte. And sure enough, the Aryeh DeBeiloi leaves its place in Beiloi and starts getting on the move to come towards Rome or towards Syria or to wherever this conversation was taking place. She have a Marchak Arameya Parsi, when this creature that the Aryeh DeBeiloi was 400 parsa away, which is like 900 miles, Nihem Chadkola, it gave one loud roar. And it was so loud and so powerful, I feel a coma about it, Ashura de Roimi Nopo, that all of the bridges and all of the walls of Rome fell down from the power of it. Adamur, and it's still coming closer. Adamurach class may piracy. It came 300 parasa away, it's 100 parasa closer. Nihim Kolachrina, it gave another big roar. Notur Kachi Vishini de Gavri, and people's teeth and molars fell out from the fear of it. And even he, the emperor himself, fell off his throne from the fear of it. So he says to Rabbi Yeshua, please, I beg you, daven for Rachmanus from Hashem, that it should go back to its place. Sure enough, Barach Mialei, so Rabbi Yeshua duly davened for it, Ba'adalei L'Asrei, and returned it to its place, and it wasn't threatening Rome anymore. So the point is, so he never saw it, but the point is, so Rabbi Yeshua was right. You're not going to be able to manage to see it, but therefore he got an idea. So this is allegorical. It is allegorical, and one idea of it is again that he's thinking that Hashem is not the ultimate power, and he's being shown that look, this creature, which is only one of Hashem's creations, is still enough to terrorize your city. But also this thing from Reb Chaim Hirschhausen, he says that therefore maybe the lion of the Faya de Beloi represents the Persians, like when they're your great rivals, the Romans. You even hear that they're on the march, and all of a sudden you guys are all Anyway. All right. Another example, another one of these conversations, Amalek Kesa to Rabbi Shurban Hananya. Another time the emperor says to Rabbi Shurban Hananya, or maybe in continuation of this one, but in the Echzilai Lekaichu, I want to see your God. So now Mephoshim explained, the previous one is he thought Hashem is not all powerful. Now he realizes that, but still he thinks maybe I can understand, maybe, like to see means that Marshal explains to be able to understand. The Maharal says, given that, you're saying Hashem created all the physical world, then obviously, so there's a case of figures. In that case, there must be some physical aspect to him, which we could be able to see. Amalei, so again, Rabbi Yeshua tells him, you're not going to be able to. Amalei, and the emperor says, Amalei, he says, yet, nevertheless, indeed, Chazinalei, I'm going to see him, make it happen. So Rabbi Yeshua takes the emperor out and has him stand outside under the sun in Tkufas Tammuz, in the heat of the summer. Amalei is stakobei, he says, look up at the sun. Amalei lemetzina, and the emperor says, I can't, I'll go blind. Amalei, Rabbi Yeshua tells him, look at that. Yoma, the chad meshamshi, kaime kame kuchabrichu, the daylight, the sunlight, which is only one of the servants that stand before Hashem, amrit lemasinale staklebe, and you're saying I can't look at it. Shinale koshikin, how much more so? You're not going to be able to look at Hashem himself. So in other words, also the idea, like you think you can even understand anything about Elokus, you can't even see the full power of the sun, and really, which is a creation of Hashem, and which is sort of like partway between the physical and the spiritual and whatever, and nevertheless you can't even half that. How much more so to be able to see Hashem himself?
Did he stop there, or did he still request some more?
So then this comes the next one. Amalei, so the emperor, Amalei case a little bit Shurban Hananya, but in it's bisle nahamalei lekaihu. Okay, I want to make a meal for your Hashem. So now Maharsha explains what it is. Is he went, there was a process over here. First he thought Hashem is not all powerful.
Right.
Now, then he thought that maybe he can understand something about Hashem. And he can't even do that. Now he says that, okay, on the other hand, the fact is you're saying Hashem created a physical world. So therefore, in that case, then it's possible to make him a physical meal. It's possible to relate to him on a physical level. Amalei, and again, Rabbi Yeshua tells him, Leimotis, you're not going to be able to. So the emperor says, why not? Am I? And Rabbi Yeshua tells him, Nefishei Chelevosei, because Hashem has a lot of soldiers. He has a very large army. Nefishei Chelevosei. He has many soldiers. In other words, In other words, like if you're going, you make a party, you make a meal for Hashem, so to speak. You have to not just be you don't just serve Hashem. You have to serve all of the Meshorsim as well, and you have a lot of them, far too many for you to be able to do. Amalei, and again, the emperor, being a stubborn guy, says, Ivra, indeed, I'm going to do it. I'm the emperor. I have the capability to do it. Amalei, so Rabbi Yeshua tells him, okay, fine, here's how you can go about doing it. Puk svis legida de revisa, go arrange this, and he had said, isvis, I want to prepare a meal. So go prepare this meal, legida de revisa, on the banks of revisa. So Rashi explains that revisa is the name of a river. Rashi explains, Shemna al Sasna Shashmo Revisa. Steinsaltz brings that also in some Middle Eastern languages, Revisa means the ocean, so maybe it means by the seashore, whatever it is. The point is it's a big wide area. You can set up an appropriate kind of a banquet over there. Durvichalma, because it's very wide over there this way, so to speak, all of Hashem's soldiers can gather over there. Meanwhile, Rashi explains Rabbi Yeshua had an ulterior motive over here. He wanted him to set it up in a place that's going to end up being very windy by the seashore. Well, you see why. Because he wanted to show him he can't do it. Ultimately, he wanted to show that his conception of Elokus is completely wrong. Okay. So Torach Shita Yarchi Kaita. So the emperor spends works for 6 months preparing this grand banquet. Also Zika. Then at the end of the 6 months, the wind comes, kind of a hurricane or whatever, Kan Sheliyama, and swept everything out to sea. Still didn't give up. Torach Shita Yarchi De Sitra. So he set up. He works for 6 months till the winter. And then at the end of that, also Mitra Tave Biyama, and a big rainstorm came, and again it all drowned it in the ocean. Amalei Mai Hai, the emperor comes to Rabbi Shimon and says, "What's going on over here? The six months of preparing, and it's not fair, basically." Amalei, so Rabbi Shimon says, "That wasn't even Hashem himself yet. Hani Knushoi Zuluchoi Also Kamei. Those are all just the sweepers, the janitors, the sweepers, and the ones who lay down, who sprinkle water or liquids or whatever to lay down the dust." Before even the important guests start coming, you have people to prepare the place. And so they came and did that. They have the sweepers, which is the wind, and the ones who lay down the dirt by sprinkling water as the clouds that brought rain. Also kamei, which they came before Hashem came, and some of them Mephoshim say also what it is Rabbi Yeshua is telling him while they were there doing their work, they took their share of the they're entitled to a certain share of the banquet as well. They worked, so then while they were there, they took their share.
And
left
everything else.
Yeah, Amalei, the emperor says, you know what, so then you're right, I can't manage. I can't manage with that kind of thing. So he realized, he starts realizing that even he has this conception that because Hashem created the physical world, therefore he has some relationship to the physical world, and now he realizes that. Okay. Now that was enough with the emperor. Now Amalei Bas case a little bit Shulman Hananya. Now the daughter of the emperor gets involved over there. And she one time says to Rabbi Shulman Hananya, the same Rabbi Yeshua, she starts like this, Elekechen Nagrohu. Apparently your Hashem... No, Rabbi Shulman Hananya was not one of the Asara Rabbi Malfas. He passed away before the war and the Shmab and everything happened. Anyway, so she says to him, Elekechen Nagrohu. Apparently, based on your own things in your Tanakh, Hashem, your Hashem is a carpenter. Because you have a pasuk that describes, I'm a korev amayim al Yosef, that Hashem roofs over his upper stories with water. It's referring to the creation of the heavens. So to speak, Hashem made them like a carpenter building a roof. Hamakore, he roofs b'mayim with water al Yosef his upper stories. Okay, so he's a carpenter. So therefore, she says, "Emalei de nevad lichodem misturisa." In that case, if your Hashem knows how to work with wood like that, then let him make me a misturisa, which is a spindle for spinning wool or other fibers like that. It's usually a long stick made out of wood.
Why should Hashem make her a spindle?
So among the various explanations over here, some of the Mephoshim explain that what it is she was claiming, as many philosophers then and since have claimed, that okay, you're saying Hashem created the world, but he didn't create it out of nothing, as we Jews understand it. She claims there was already a raw material there that pre-existed, and Hashem just shaped it like the way a carpenter takes a piece of wood and shapes it into something that he needs.
Yeah.
So therefore, in that case, then Hashem could be doing the same thing now. Hashem could take, all I think Hashem is capable of is doing something like that, like taking an existing piece of wood and making a spindle out of it, not creating something from nothing. Beni Hayyadr also has an interesting explanation. A spindle turns and whirls round and round. She was arguing like this. You're saying that Hashem makes things happen, but look, even you, Rabbi Yeshua, are saying when Hashem, let's say, for example, wants to make a person rich, he doesn't directly have that money showers down on him from Shemayim. What Hashem does is Hashem brings about through various apparently natural events that the person ends up getting rich, or the same thing with any other thing. So like it's, so to speak, like a spindle going round and round. So in that case, she says to Rabbi Yeshua, in that case, I want your Hashem to make me, to make something that completely out of left field happen to me. Let him start putting events, putting wheels and wheels in motion to make something unexpectedly good, let's say, happen to me.
It's a little more abstract.
A little more abstract, right. Okay. Omar, so Rabbi Yeshua says, L'chaye, okay, very well. L'chaye, very good. I'll arrange it. Barach mi Allah, so he davens about her. The inoga, and she ended up getting tzaras. Well, oisva b'shuka deroimi. So what happened was she was made to sit in the marketplace of Rome. The yahavi lo misturisa, and they gave her a spindle to work with. Dehavu Nehigi, this was a minhag, this was the custom among the Romans, called the minaga baroimi, anybody in Rome who gets taras, Yahavu le misturi. So they would do that. They would give them a spindle. It would be like a sign of the disease that they have, the fact that they're carrying around a spindle. I don't know why they adapted it a spindle, but one possibility Steinsaltz mentions, I don't remember if it's his own idea or not, you actually find in Tanakh, you find that infirm people, like people who couldn't walk properly, you have a pasuk in Shmuel that mentions them walking, like leaning on a spindle for support, sort of like a cane. So maybe the idea was people with saras are often infirm, so maybe the idea was like this, it could do, they could be doing useful work, but also they could use it to support themselves. Anyway, and the idea was, So they would give the person a spindle, the yosef b'shuka, they would sit in the marketplace, the sasa dulali, and they would use the spindle to unwind spools of thread or balls of yarn or whatever. And the reason they had them do that, this way, when you see somebody sitting over there and using a spindle to unwind these balls of yarn, you would know automatically that they have saras, and this way people would daven for them. This way they it would be a matter of public knowledge so that people could go to their local temple and daven to whatever getchka they wanted to on behalf of these poor people. So they did that for her also. So, you know, that's them's the rules, and even the emperor is not gonna bend the rules for his daughter. So Yom Echad have a kacholit hasam. One day Rabbi Shua is passing by over there by that particular marketplace. And sure enough, she's sitting over there and unwinding these spools of thread using her spindle. So Rabbi Shua says to her, Shapiro Misturisa, Diyav Lachalakai. Look at that, my Hashem gave you a very nice spindle. You wanted a spindle, you got a spindle. And that's Ben Yehoyada explains that what he was saying is it's not just a physical spindle. He's saying you were saying that Hashem should make something happen completely out of left field, like Hashem should put events into motion going round and round. Well, you had something unusual happen to you. You would never have expected that you'd be in such a situation, and there you are. So she says to him, okay, well then tell your Hashem to take away what he gave me. I don't want it. I don't want that kind of thing. Amalah, he says, no good. El Kodidon may have Yahav Mishkal Loshakal. Our Hashem gives. He doesn't take back.
Well, he can take back.
Well, as a matter of fact, there is you have that kind of thing. It comes up in various places. It's an unusual thing. You have, for example, so on the side of here, it references the Gemara in Tainis. You have the story involving Rav Shimon Chalakta, I think it was, or Rav Hanina Mendoza, I don't remember. He was very poor, and then he's given a table leg. I think it was Rav Hanina Mendoza. He's given a table leg min hashamayim, because he's complaining, he's davening and complaining about how poor he is. So he's given this table leg. And his wife says, well, then wait a minute, what does that mean? Lasid lava in Olam Haba, all the tzaddikim are going to be sitting at a four-legged table, and you're going to be sitting only at a three-legged table. In other words, you're taking away some of your reward in Olam Haba. So he davens, and it's taken back, which is an unusual thing, because usually when Hashem gives you something, he doesn't take it back. So here, Rabbi Yeshua is telling her the same thing. Hashem gives some. Part of it is also, I mean, Rabbi Yeshua is telling her, look, you know, she's obviously not ready to do tshuva yet. She's still, you know, she's just being very arrogant about it. Like, okay, I don't want it. Let him take it back. Well, then fine. Hashem doesn't take back just because you want. Yeah. Anyway, the point is she also learned her lesson about how Hashem runs.
What happened, we don't know.
So what happened, we don't know. But Pashtus, she stayed that way. Okay. Almer of Yehuda.
Didn't take revenge on...
I don't know. She may not have been in a position to. I don't know. Okay. All right. Going back to animals for a moment. Almer of Yehuda. Shur, Kausatan uparsatan. A normal ox should be kausatan and has a very big stomach, a very wide stomach.
Yeah,
kausatan, and it usually has very wide, rounded hooves. Like I showed you the picture the other day, that a horse's hoof, not a horse's, a cow's hooves are usually more round. They're split, but they're rounded. On the other hand, and also rav reshed has a big head. The rav gnufte, and it has a long tail. The chilufa b'chamra, all of those things are just the opposite when it comes to a donkey. A donkey is usually a much more spare animal. It doesn't have a big wide stomach. Its hooves are not that shape. They're more pointed. It doesn't chew its cud and doesn't have split hooves. But the point is that a donkey is exactly the opposite of a shur in that regard. So the question is, well, my nakamina, okay, why is that important to know? The reason is as far as buying and selling. If a person is selling an ox, the buyer has the right to expect that the ox is going to have those particular characteristics. And the same thing if you're selling somebody a donkey. So therefore, it's important to know, as far as Mecha Homemka, it's important to know what you should be expecting to get. If somebody sold you an ox, were you expecting to get a normal ox, and you get one that's not big and wide like that, or that doesn't have a big head or whatever, then you know you're not really getting the genuine article necessarily. Okay. V'amar Rav Yehuda. Also, Rav Yehuda says another thing about animals. We mentioned before the keresh, which has one horn. So here's another animal that has one horn. Sure, Shehikruv, Adam Arishan, the ox that Adam Arishan brought to the Korban, we learned in Avodah Zarah, the story, Rashi references it over here, that you have the last 8 days before Tkufas Tevis, that the days are getting shorter and shorter, and Adam is nervous that the world is going to come to an end, and then it starts getting longer and longer, and he realizes, Olam Tumin Hagi Noeg, and the same thing, Bechlal, when it gets dark by night, and then it got light the next morning. So the Gemara says that afterwards, Adam was so grateful to Hashem that he brought a Korban. So this ox that Adam brought of the korban, keren achas hoisaloi b'mitzchay. It had one horn in the middle of its forehead. Shenemar, and we know that because the pasuk in Tehillim that says
you're allowed to bring such a korban.
Yeah, that's what we said before. It's a kosher animal, so this was also a kosher animal. It had it chewed its cud. It had split hooves. Well, there is actually the prechadash that. Okay, so the Prechadash on the Gemara before actually says that the Keresh may be the rhinoceros, in which case it would not be a kosher animal. We brought a Braisa that says that it is, but in that case, if it's a rhino, it wouldn't be. But not necessarily. But Pashtus, it could mean that it was some type of ox. Maybe it doesn't even exist anymore. Maybe it's extinct. I don't know. That has only one horn. Yeah, but that doesn't mean. Well, here we're not talking about halacha. Here we're talking about what Adam Arishan did right after he was created. It doesn't mean that in the 5,700 odd years since then, it might not have gone extinct. But besides that, it could also be some undiscovered species. It could be it was a mutant that had only one horn, whatever. Anyway, it had only one horn. Shenema, because you have a pasuk in Tehillim that says, V'sitav l'Hashem mishur per makrin makrin. David HaMelech says about his tefillah to Hashem, may it be better to Hashem, more acceptable to Hashem, than a shur per. A shur means an ox. Par also means an ox. But the point is that a shur can be an animal even on the day that it was born. A par, by definition, is an animal a couple of years old. So it means it was a newly created animal. It was made on that day, like all the other animals were, and yet it was already like a par in being fully grown. As the Gemara was going to say in a minute, that all the animals were created fully grown.
So shur is newly born.
Shur can be newly born, like it's a shur ekesev. Par means that it has to be in a third year. Yeah, it means it's in the third year. So sherper, makrin matris, that has horn and has hoof. So the question is, makrin tauti mashma, when it says it has horns, usually it means that it has two horns. Most oxen have two horns. So how does that imply that it had only one horn? The answer is, the Amr of Nachman, mi keren, see, because in the pasuk it's written makrin without the yud. So it can be read as if it said mi keren, from a horn. So an animal that only has one horn. What's the symbolism that it has only one horn? There's a lot of different explanations among the Mepharshim, including one that Marsha says that what it is that by eating from the Eitz Hadas, the Nachash was trying to convince them, so to speak, as Rashi says on the Pesukim, like so to speak, Hashem is jealous of his prerogatives. He doesn't want others to eat from the Eitz Hadas, so they can't create worlds like him. So effectively, then Adam has a certain idea that there's more than one power in the world. So now he brings this ox with one horn to demonstrate that he's done sugar for that, and he no longer believes in that, and he accepts that there's one Hashem represented by the one horn. There's a lot of other explanations. There's a lot of other explanations. Everybody has their take on it. One of them is another one is also that the one horn in the middle of the forehead represents the derech hamitzua, the median path in most middos that a person should usually take. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that usually in most middos you usually have in various character traits you have the extremes and then you have the median, and usually a person should follow the median, so it can represent that Adam is committing himself to that. Anyway, okay. This ox that Adam brought as a korban, its horns came before its hooves, which means two things. First of all, usually a baby cattle are born without horns. They develop the horns later. Here, since all the animals that were created in Ma'aseh Bereishis were created fully grown, so it had its horns already when it was created, because it was created fully grown. And also there's the idea that since Hashem created all the animals out of the earth. So therefore, like, they came out of the earth head first. So So therefore, the head, which has horns on it, comes out before the hooves, which are at the bottom of the body, as opposed to there's no being born over here. It's being created out of the earth. Created. As opposed to when a baby shur is born, first of all, it doesn't have horns yet. They develop only later. But second of all, its front legs are in front of its head. It's a baby shur is born, front legs first, and then its head. So therefore, its hooves come out before the place where its horns are going to be, whereas here, by my interpretation, it is the other way around. Yeah. So that's
so
that.
So it's different from humans.
So
the head comes first.
Right. Shenem, I was the apostle says, the speech of Hashem.
Does that have a spiritual meaning also?
Could be. I don't know.
The ground connection is much.
Not sure. I didn't look that up. Okay, Shenema is the same pasuk. V'sitav Hashem mishor po makrin mafris. Again, because the pasuk says that David is asking, my tefillah should be better for Hashem than the shor par, which is makrin mafris, that has horn and has hooves, which implies makrin b'reishav ahadim mafris. First the horns, then the hooves. So again, with a regular animal, it's not like that. It's born hooves first, and later on the horns develop when it becomes mature. Whereas over here, the horns emerged from the ground first because it was created fully grown with the horns, and then the hooves afterwards.
So the horns, the head.
So in other words, it comes out. It comes out. So it's like it comes out of the ground. So the Gemara says, "Misayilei le'Rabbi Shur ben Levi." This statement that we just said about the ox that Adam brought as a carbon supports what Rabbi Shur ben Levi says. The Amr Rabbi Shur ben Levi, "Kol Ma'aseh Bereishis." Everything that Hashem created in Ma'aseh Bereishis became Masa Nivu. They were created at their full height. So therefore, in this case, in other words, yes. So it came out of the ground, standing up, basically. So therefore, its horns came out first. Tosfos says, okay, it doesn't necessarily mean all the creatures actually came out standing up. All it means is they were created in their full size. They weren't created as babies. Also, b'daita nivru, they were also created with their das, which means that, so to speak, Rashi says that Hashem informed them they're going to be created, and they agreed to it. And b'tzivyonim nivru, and they were all created with tzivyonim. With tzivyonim, Rashi says, means b'dmus shebacher lehem, like, so to speak, they picked for themselves what they want to look like. And Hashem created them according to that. You have other explanations. Another explanation is that tzivyon means their desire. That's also what means that they agreed to it. There's a variety of explanations. Shenet also means in their beauty, in their fully developed form. Shenema is a pasuk says, "Vayichulu Hashemayim ba'aretz hotzvam al tikri tzvam el tzivyonim." Don't read the pasuk tzvam that their host, but rather the word tzvam also includes tzivyonim, their beauty or their desire or whatever.
Tzivyonim
is rather. So that's the thing. Rashi over here explains tzivyonim as meaning dmus shebacher lahem, the form that they chose for themselves. And you have other explanations of what tzivyonim. You have other explanations of what tzivyonim means. That it means their desire, or it means their beauty, or whatever. So whatever it is, all of those are included because the pasuk didn't have to use the word tzvam. Because it said vaychol hashemayim ba'aretz, vaychol shebahem, or whatever. The fact that it uses the word tzvam is. So Rashi on the pasuk, but they also explain tiknam b'tzivyonim of kemasa means that Hashem made them in their full form and in their full height and everything. This is the famous thing they talk about, for example, when the earth looks like it's much older than 577 whatever years old, is because everything was created fully grown. So therefore, the famous thing they say, if you cut open a tree on the day it was created, you would find rings in it as if it had already lived for hundreds or thousands or whatever of years. And the same thing with all the other animals. So it was created, everything was created in its full form, among other things, because Hashem created the world perfect. Hashem created the world perfect. And then after that, it's our job to improve it. But in other words, if the creatures had been created like not fully formed or whatever, then it would, so to speak, it might have falsely implied that Hashem doesn't have the full power, Kavyachol, to create them.
So the world was created, in physics they say it was created pinpointedly.
So maybe, that's a different thing. You have Gemaras that talk about Sha'oma lo lomay died, the world was expanding until Hashem told it enough. So you can make all these things work with this. Okay. You have the famous expression, what came first, the chicken or the egg? We see from this Gemara, the answer is the chicken came first because everything was created fully formed. Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah. Dora Shab Chanina Bar Papa. Since we're talking about Ma'ase Bereishis, let's talk a little more about Ma'ase Bereishis. Shab Chanina Bar Papa said a drasha. You have a pasuk in Tehillim that says, "Yehi chvod Hashem la'olam, yismach Hashem b'masav." May the glory of Hashem be forever. May Hashem be happy with His work.
We say,
Yeah, we do say it on Simchas Torah. It's also at the end of Baruch Hinapshi that we say on Rosh Chodesh. Yeah. Okay. So the question is that what's bothering Rav Chanina Bar Papa is why is it written in future tense? If we're talking about the world that already exists, yeah, Yehi and Yismach, in particular Yismach. If we're talking about the world that already exists, rather that already existed by the time David wrote this kapitel, Sadach Hashem b'masav, Hashem was happy with what he created. Why Yismach? A pasuk zeh sar ha'olam amri. So Rav Chanina Bar Papa says this pasuk was actually originally said by the sar ha'olam, the malach in charge of things in the world.
That's not created.
Hashem created the world, but the point is,
He didn't delegate.
No, of course, no. Hashem didn't delegate. But what it is sar ha'olam, like so to speak, the malach who is in charge of things in the world. Tosfos talks about that malach might be matat, which actually is very appropriate to this parasha because we have in this parasha where Hashem offers to send a malach with the Jewish people. You know, nefesh shelech malach lefanecha, and Rashi says that's matat. So, actually, Moshe didn't want it. Moshe actually refused it. No, the people actually didn't want a malach either originally. Well, I don't know what they wanted, but whatever. Moshe actually later on in Parashat Kisisa says, if you're going to send a malach and not come with us yourself, then we don't want to leave you. We're not moving. And Hashem says, okay, then I'll lead you instead. And the malach instead comes.
This,
we're talking about after Yitzhak Mitzrayim in Parashat Mishpatim, in our parasha, Hashem says to Moshe, Hini Anochi Shaleach Malach Lefanecha. Rashi explains on the pasuk that Hashem is saying that Hashem knows everything in advance, so he knew that there was going to be a chet ha'egel, and therefore the Jewish people are not going to be worthy of having the Shechina itself go with them, so Hashem says that. Later on, in Parashat Kisisa, Hashem says, okay, now it's time, I'm going to send a malach with you, and Moshe says, absolutely not, if you're not coming with us personally, don't take us out of here, don't move us from Har Sinai, we're going to stay put, and Hashem says, okay, I'm listening to you, I will lead you myself. Later on, in Yeshua's time, the malach comes to him, and he starts to Hashem at the bossy because your Rebbe Moshe didn't want me, but now that's your time. Now then I'm going to lead you Jewish people in conquering Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, so Rashi says on the pasuk that malach is matat. So here also, so he's sara olam. He's like he's a malach. I mean, Tosfos actually discusses over here the possibility. There are midrashim that say that Matat is actually Chanoich, the descendant of Adam, the great-grandfather of Noach, who that he became a malach. So there's midrashim that say that he became Matat. So our Gemara seems to not be going according to that, because our Gemara is talking about the Sara Olam existing when the world was created already. Okay, midrash is Chalukas, as it often is. Anyway, so this is Sar Ha'olam. In Chassidus, it talks about the idea that Matat is a malach in Olam HaYitzira, so since we're in Olam HaAtzira, so, you know, from our point of view, he's infinitely, so, well, it's only one world higher, but every world is infinitely, it seems to be infinitely higher than the previous one, because it's not really comprehensible by the world below it, so yeah. Okay. Anyway, so this pasuk, Sar Ha'olam Amr. What it is like this. B'shal she'omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'minehu be'ilonis. Now, on the third day of Ma'aseh Bereishis, Hashem says to the trees that directly to the trees or to the malachim in charge of the trees, whatever it is that Hashem.
So wasn't the malach in charge of speaking to the trees?
No. Hashem himself is creating. Hashem is creating. The Sara Olam is responsible to maybe to whatever it is. I don't know what his responsibility. But anyway, we also know that each thing has its own malach. Anyway, the point is. So what does Hashem say over there? Vayomer Elokim. What's the lashon? Tad she aris desha esev mazriya zera eight pri osef pri leminoi asher zare bayalar. So Hashem says the earth should sprout forth vegetation, grasses, and other such plants, right? And trees that reproduce according to their kind. The eight osef pri asher zare bayalar according to their kind, meaning that each tree has to stay separate. Well, in other words, it could have that trees can be crossbred, trees can be cross-rafted, for example.
Ah.
Yeah. So, not when Hashem said leminehu be'ilonis, when Hashem says that the trees should be leminehu, that each species should stay separate and not be intermingled, nosu deshoyim kavachomer ba'atman. So the grasses, the herbs, made a kavachomer for themselves, or the malach in charge of them, as the case may be, made a kavachomer for himself to realize what they should do. They figured
they were not addressed.
Well, right. But they figure, Im Ritzona Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Rububya, they think like this. If Hashem wants things to come mixed up, Lama Om L'Minehu B'Ilonis, then why would he have said L'Minehu about the trees, that they should remain separate? V'Oid, so therefore, in other words, we should also, therefore, keep ourselves separate. V'Oid, and furthermore, they realize another Kavos Haimer. Uma Ilonis She'ein Darken Lotus B'Rububya, Madach trees, where anyway, by nature, they stay apart, because they're larger life forms. By nature, trees don't grow that close together.
Right.
And yes, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Minehu, and still Hashem has to stress L'Minehu that each tree should come out by itself and separate, and each species should be visibly separate, whatever. Onu Alachas Kama V'Kama. So we, little grasses and herbs, which usually grow, which are much smaller things and usually grow much closer together, so if we don't make sure that each one is separate, then there's going to be an intermingling. Alachas Kama V'Kama. So how much more so we have to make sure that each one of us grows in its own place and they don't get intermingled.
Except that Hashem created the trees very separate from each other and the grass very close, or intermingled.
Okay, so what we're saying over here, what the pasuk over here is saying is that Hashem created that Hashem created them with these natures, but then the Deshoyim made a kavachomer for themselves to realize, because Hashem is creating us, that we by nature grow much closer together, therefore we should take extra care that we also follow this thing of L'Minehu, even if Hashem didn't tell it to us.
So why did Hashem create them so close to each other?
Because of this, so this way they made the kavachomer. So wait, miyad kolachad v'achad yotz l'mino. Sure enough, each one came out according to its separately according to its own kind, and they don't crossbreed. Pasach sara olam ba'omer. So seeing that sara olam matas is very pleased, and he says, look at that, yichvod Hashem la'olam yismach Hashem ma'isav. The glory of Hashem should be forever. Hashem should be happy. That's why it's in future tense with his creation. But look at that, all of his creations are very careful to follow what he says, even if he didn't tell them directly. So what does it mean? I mean, obviously it's not necessarily meant so literally. It has a literal meaning as well. But for example, Rabbi Yonasan Ibishitz mentions in one of his drushas that the idea is like the grasses represent like the more physical, the more low, the down to earth nature of man, because they're one of the lowest life forms out there,
right,
as opposed to trees are the higher ones. So therefore, like if even the grasses realize that they should control themselves and go against their nature and come out L'Minehu, so a person, the idea is that a person also needs to, it's meant as a lesson for a person, that also a person is capable of controlling his lower nature or whatever. And therefore, the Sfarah Olam is saying, Yisnach Hashem Amaisa, because that Hashem created a human being also with the ability to be able to do that, to be able to overcome their natural tendencies and whatever.
But he created the trees so that they should never intermingle with each other. It's very easy for the trees.
Well, nevertheless, I mean, trees can be cross-grafted, but
they are.
Okay.
By themselves, they cannot.
Fine, but okay, that's the point. In other words, so nevertheless, Hashem tells them, L'Minehu, that you have to stay true to your kind and not grow together and not intermingle. So that's the thing. They made a kavachomer. So that, okay, you have to look at the psukim over there. Okay, so what it is you have to look at the psukim. In the psukim, when Hashem first gives the command that there should be grasses and trees, so let's read the psukim. Vayomer Elohim, tad she'aretz desha, the earth should be covered with herbs, esev mazriya zera, grasses and herbs that produce seeds. Eitz pri oisev pri l'minoi, there should be fruit trees that produce fruit according to their kind, asher zarei ba'al ha'aretz, the seeds of them will go into the ground to produce new ones, v'ayichayin, and it was so.
So it only says
l'minoi by the tree.
Exactly.
But v'toitzei ha'aretz desha, but the earth gave forth vegetation, esev mazriya zera, l'minehu, grasses and herbs and whatever that give seed according to their kind. So we see that the grasses are l'minehu even though Hashem hadn't told them that. That's the kavachomer that we're saying that they made. So therefore, the Sfarah Olam is saying, look, Hashem should be very pleased with what he created, that the grasses and the malachim in charge of them or whatever are able to make such a kavachomer and be so punctilious about what Hashem wants.
The
Torah says, Desha Esev Mazriya Zer Aleminehu. Mazriya Zer
Aleminehu.
So it means, in other words, that they kept to their own kind. No, it means that they keep to their own kind. They don't interbreed with others. So in this connection, a little bit of halacha, boy Ravina, in the middle of our gadda, a little bit of halacha, boy Ravina. So Ravina asks in this connection. Hirkif shnei deshoyim zeh al gav zeh. Suppose a person grafts together two types of herbs, one with the other. The Rav Chanina bar Papa mahu, according to Rav Chanina ben Papa, bar Papa, who says that the grasses were not actually, the herbs, whatever, were not actually told to stay, to not intermingle. They figured that out on their own. So according to him, is or would you be allowed to intermingle them by cross-grafting? Okay, one second. First of all, you have to realize like this, as a little bit of background. There is an issue in the Torah to cross-graft trees. Now, there is such a thing, Kalai Ilonis. What's the only thing that's also, as far as trees in Halacha, is to graft a branch of one species onto another. It's not also, for example, to plant seeds of two different trees together. It's not also to pollinate one from the other or whatever. The only thing that's also is cross-grafting. Cross-grafting in specifically
tree with an apple tree.
But you have to understand, only grafting. You would be allowed to, let's say, take pollen from a peach tree and put it on an apple tree. You would be allowed to plant a peach seed and an apple seed next to each other. The only thing that violates Laminehu is to graft the branch of one onto the other. That's how it is. That's the Gemara mentions it in other places. And that's how it is. That's halacha. So the question is then over here, what about would the same thing be true of herbs? That you're allowed to plant herbs next to each other, so Tosfos talks about like this. Now, you have a Mishnah in Masechet Kilayim that says clearly you're not allowed to graft one type of vegetable into the other. So what's the question in the Gemara over here? And the Mishnah actually gives examples over there of kind of planting one herb inside another, for example. So Tosfos brings up a couple of possibilities. First of all, maybe the question over here is only in Chutz La'aretz. In Chutz La'aretz, you are allowed to do whatever you want with vegetables. You are allowed to plant vegetables together. It's only in Eretz Yisrael that you have rules about separating them. But outside Eretz Yisrael, you're still not allowed to cross-graft trees. So the question would be, fine, you're allowed to plant different vegetables together in Chutz La'aretz, but are you allowed to cross-graft them? So again, if we say that Hashem commanded the herbs and vegetables to stay separate, well, then the same thing would apply to them as trees. So if it's also with trees, it would be also with them. But according to the Chanin and Bar Papa, that they did it on their own, would you be over if you violated that?
Right.
So that's one possibility Tosfos brings up. Another possibility Tosfos brings up is that maybe the question is over here that maybe there's only certain kinds of seeds or certain kinds of herbs that it would be also in Torah. So the question would be, what about other ones? Another possibility is maybe we're talking about B'nai Noach. You have a Gemara in Sanhedrin that we learned a while back that when it discusses the Sheva Mitzvot of B'nai Noach, you have an opinion over there that Goyim are also not allowed to cross-graft trees. So therefore, the question is, would they be allowed to cross-graft herbs, vegetables? Okay. So that's the question.
So
you have a variety of questions. Anyway,
trees
we know you're not allowed in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. And according to one opinion in Sanhedrin over there, even goyim are not allowed to.
Where do we derive also
because you have, I don't remember the exact derivation, but whatever it is, the point is, because you have that you're not allowed to. So what's the question? On the one hand, so the question is, on the one hand, given the like kasabu l'minehu l'mechayev, given that the Torah doesn't say by the herbs l'minehu, so maybe you're not chayev for cross grafting them, oydom given to hiskimayadayu, or maybe since Hashem agreed with what they did, command dichtibu l'minehu damia. So it's as if it's said by the command by them l'minehu. The answer is teiku. We don't know. Okay. Again, I mean, you know, given that you have this, so again, with all those possibilities that Tosfos brought up, actually, given that, especially if we're talking only in Chutz La'aretz, then the whole issue of grafting trees over there would anyway only be midrabban. So therefore, so we can be mako on this when it comes to vegetables. Okay.
But the pasuk in Minehu is not saying
a mitzvah. It's not saying don't cross graft them. Later on, you have whatever. So, okay.
So it's a narrative only?
Yeah, over here in Parashat Bereishis, it's only a narrative. Okay. All right. Talking more about Maase Bereishis, very famous Agadah.
It's not a mitzvah not to do with
it. Yeah, outside Eretz Yisrael when it comes to trees.
Outside
Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, it's also Daraisi. Okay, since we're talking about Maase Bereishis, well, that's the question, whether the grasses or not. In this particular case, especially if we're talking only outside Eretz Yisrael, then you can be made because it's Rabban. In Eretz Yisrael, you might have to be Machmir. Okay. Rav Shimon ben Pazi Romi. So now we have another thing about Maase Bereishis. It's a very famous Agadah.
Yeah.
Aktiv Vayasa Lekimas Shneam Oris Agdolim. You have one
story we had of Rav Shimon ben Pazi.
We didn't, but we had now where we were talking about Maase Bereishis. So we're talking more about Maase Bereishis. When it talks about on the fourth day that Hashem says Hashem created the two great luminaries, meaning the sun and the moon, implying that they were both the same size. Uchtevas Amora Godovas Amora Cotton, and the next pasuk says calls them the large luminary and the small luminary. So what is it? Are they the same size or are they different sizes? So what it is?
The sun is not the largest in the universe.
We didn't say it is, but in terms of us from Earth, it is. And in terms of us from Earth, it appears the largest.
It's very small.
That's fine. That's neither here nor there. The Torah was given to us on Earth. The Torah wasn't given to the aliens on a planet.
The sun that's 20 trillion times the size of the sun.
Okay, Kenzai. Okay.
20 trillion times.
Oh, no, that's fine. Okay, so what happened over here? How is it that the pasuk is first describing them as both big, which implies they're both equally the same size, and then it's saying one is big, one is small, like this. Amr Yereach Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the moon says to Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Efshel L'Shnei Melachim Sheishtam Shel B'Keser Echad. How is it possible that two kings should use the same scepter? In other words, how can it be that there are two equal size bodies in the sky? It would be like two rival kings. Sheishtam Shel B'Keser Echad, that they should use, not a scepter, sorry, that they should use one crown. How can two kings share the same crown? How can me and the sun be the same size?
Well, the sun shares it during the day, and the moon at night.
Okay. Amr Allah, so Hashem tells the moon, go diminish yourself. You're saying we can't be the same size. Okay, well then, in that case, then make yourself smaller. Amr Allah, Ribbono Shel Olam, so the moon says to Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam, Hayovar Marti Lefanecha Dabar Hagun Amit Atzmi. Because I said a logical thing to you, because I said a logical argument, I should have to diminish myself. Oh, yes, famous thing. Amr Allah, so Hashem tells the moon, okay, l'chi u'mashur b'yom v'layla. Go, and you'll rule by day and by night. Because in other words, the sun is only visible by day, as opposed to the moon is visible at night, and often also during the day. Amr Alei, so the moon says, what is that? What good does that do? Ma'ir abuse, what's the big thing of being able to... Okay, well, hold on. Let's finish the story, and then we'll talk about. So the moon says to Hashem, so what's the big deal being able to be seen by day? The shraga b'tira mayahani, what good does a candle do in the middle of the day? In other words, the same thing. If you see the moon in the middle of the day, it doesn't give any light. It's drowned out by the light of the sun. Amallah, so Hashem tells the moon, zil, go. And it's okay because limnu bach Yisrael yom mishanim. The Jewish people in the future will use you, the moon, to count their days and their years. The years, obviously, because our months are moon months, and therefore the years also. Right? And as far as the days, one explanation is because our days begin by night. So in that sense, the moon is used to count our days. Okay. But the moon still says yom anami, even when it comes to counting the days. After all, it's impossible to do without the sun at all. Necessarily, the Jewish people are also going to be using the sun. They're going to be using it to count the tkufas, the seasons. Because it says that they, both of them, the sun and the moon, will be for signs and for determining the times of the Yomim Tovim and for days and for years. So therefore, the moon's saying, like, I still don't have an advantage. I have a disadvantage now because I'm smaller, but I don't have the advantage. I don't have any advantage that the sun doesn't also have. So Hashem tells it, Zil, go, and Likud Tzadiki B'Shmech. The Tzadikim will be called after you because the moon is the smaller one. And similarly, we have Tzadikim in Tanakh. You have Yaakov HaKotten. You have Yaakov is Miyokim Yaakov HaKotten, who, so the Jewish people, Yaakov and the Jewish people collectively are called Katan, like the moon is Hamor HaKotten, Shmuel HaKotten, David HaKotten. Hashem sees still the moon is not, the moon's mind is not at ease. It's still bothered by the whole situation. Hashem says to the Jewish people, bring a kapara for me that I diminish the moon.
Bring a kapara for me.
One second. Let's hold on. Let's do the next line where we see a kapara l'Hashem, and then we'll talk about the deeper meaning of this whole thing. Okay. This goes with what Rish Lakish said. We learned it in Shavuos. Why is it? Oh, you have many seirim that are brought as a chakos for the tzibur on Rish Chodesh and on Yom Tovim and whatever. Only by the one of Rish Chodesh does it say seir izim echad l'chakos l'Hashem. By all the other ones, it just says seir izim echad chakos, seir chakos echad, whatever. Only here does it say l'Hashem.
The only time that one of the chatois tzibur is described
as l'Hashem.
Not for Rosh Hashanah, not for Yom Kippur,
not that. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this sir should be a kapara that I diminish the moon. Like Hashem says, so to speak, I need a kapara for that. So what is going on over here? Like you say, how does the moon have such chutzpah, and why does Hashem need a kapara? And obviously, as you can imagine, every one of them aforeshim comments in some angle or other on what's going on with this conversation. So among others, let's see. Marsha says like this, that the moon is, as we just said, the moon is a symbol of the Jewish people. Yeah, in various places. In fact, the Gemara says, Yisrael moin in the Levana and doim in the Levana, we Jewish people count according to the moon, and we're compared to the moon, because like the moon we have our waxing and our waning seasons. So therefore, and we Jewish people are also one of the smaller nations in the world.
But we're always
there. That's fine. Just like the moon is always there. That's fine. Okay, great. So Marsha says that the remez behind this whole story over here is that Hashem is saying, like, just like Hashem is saying to the moon, you're going to be existing and you're going to be ruling by day and by night. The same thing. Hashem is telling the Jewish people that, okay, the fact that you're mamak in asmakam ba'olam hazeh, the fact that you consider yourselves humble in this world and you don't seek to dominate the world like many other nations do, that result you're going to have, therefore you exist in this world and you're also going to have olam haba. No, the point is, in other words, the Jewish people have an existence and have a presence, Lo'olam Haba, which the other nations aren't. You're going to be ruling Lo'olam Haba, in fact.
But the moon is Lo'olam Haba.
Fine. The point is that Marsha is saying this is a mashal. So then the problem with that is that still, though, the fact is we don't have a memshala in this world. It's like a moon being there when the sun is out, that the moon is barely noticeable because it's not bright. So Hashem says, okay, that you will have, you'll still have, the fact is, though, Marsha continues, when it says that you'll count yomim v'shanim, meaning, in other words, you're going to be accomplishing in this world. You're going to be doing, you're going to be doing minyan yomim v'shanim, and then through that, you're going to end up having, you're going to be able to be zorcha lo'olam haba through what you accomplished during the days and years in this world. And then they say, yeah, but after all, and then the moon, again, representing the Jewish people, says that after all, that you still have the tchukufus representing like the fact that the goyim have the great power in the world, and then Hashem says, okay, but you have the tzaddikim are called hakotan because maktinin atzman, because they consider themselves humble, like Yaakov and like David, for example, and like Shmuel hakotan. But then, nevertheless, Hashem is saying that I see you're still not at ease, that you don't have any power in this world, but we still want to have something. So Hashem says that the Surah Shodesh, there should be a kapara for me, so to speak. Like Hashem says, and with the sur, so Marsha finishes off, the sur represents Edom. So like on Rosh Chodesh, we bring it as a korban, thus weakening Edom's power, and thus saying that the Jewish, and that sometimes there'll be times when the Jewish people do have temporal power in this world, just like sometimes the moon is big.
We never
had. Of course we did. We had, for example, the time of the Bais Rishon. First of all, Shlomo Amalek was Moshe Bakipa. He ruled over the known world. But besides that, also, the point is that at times the Jewish people are greater, and sometimes they're lesser. That's how Marsha explains the whole story that way. Again, everybody has their own take on it. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of places in Chassidus, in Chassidus Chabad, where it talks about various angles of the story. One big thing that it talks about in many of them is that the whole thing over here, so among other things, we're talking about this Gemara, so the whole story over here is talking about the fact that Hashem had to make that there's a Shevirat HaKelim in the first place, that there was an Olam HaTohu, which then the Kelim of it broke apart and created the possibility for evil in the world, and therefore that's represented by the diminishing of the moon, with the moon being Malchus, which has to descend down to lower levels in order that each olam is created from malchus of the previous world. So therefore, like also the end of it is that Hashem says, so to speak, avio kapara alai. Like, yeah, in a way I'm at fault over here that I decided to create a world that was made, the Shevirat HaKelim, and that has klipas and that has sitra achra, and therefore that there's a possibility for evil, and therefore, so to speak, bring a kapara for me for the fact that I created the world that way, and that it's a world that has to be perfected and that gives the possibility for averus and whatever. In other places, it also talks about the idea that the kapara alai means, so to speak, above me, like to go even beyond shein havaya to atmos the mahus, which is the source of everything. No, in other words, the point is the kapara, in other words, one idea is that the kapara is that we're relating to Hashem on a level higher than any name of Hashem, higher than any possibility of good or evil or anything like that, on a level beyond all of that. yeah, beyond understanding, beyond anything yet. And yet another thing that it talks about is that it's also talking about the idea of why Hashem had to create the world in the way that there was a mashpia and a makabel. You have the whole world is built out of, you have the givers and you have the takers. You have the ones who have what to give and you have the ones who need to take. The fact that the point being, in other words, that Beruchnius, yes, Begashmius, okay, Begashmius many times. Begashmius many times the other way around, but whatever, the point is, it's not so much the Jewish people and the nation, but even among Jewish people themselves, you have poor people and you have rich people, and you have Talmidim who don't understand, and you have Rebbeim who do understand, so like the whole discussion back and forth, according to that, is also explaining, like Hashem it's a back and forth, why does there need to be a Mashpia, and why does there need to be a Makabel? For example, it starts with that when the moon complains, how can two kings use the same crown, it amounts to, in other words, that the moon already feels itself like it's lacking something. It feels like it needs to be a makabel. So Hashem says, okay, go diminish yourself. You feel like a makabel, you'll be the makabel. But then I don't want to be a makabel. Why should I have to be in the makabel all the time? And Hashem is going and explaining over and over what the advantage of the makabel is. But after all, you know, the makabel still feels dissatisfied. He should be able to be a mashpia as well. The fact that he has to be a makabel. So ultimately, Hashem says, "Hovio kapara alai." Like in a way, I'm at fault for having made this whole situation in the first place. I didn't have to make a world that has a mashpia and a makabel concept in the first place. I decided to make it that way, and therefore, so to speak, bring a kapara for me as a korban that I created the world that way.
In the Gifas Alvana, we said
the moon is going to be bigger. Exactly. So that's one idea that it talks about in all these places is that since we're saying over here that the diminishing of the moon represents this whole concept of, among others, of Shavitas HaKelim and the creation of the Mashpia Makabel relationship and whatever. So the point is that La'asid Lavoi, all of that will have been fixed up.
There will be a sun.
No,
the moon will not be
star. The moon will be the moon will no longer have to be a makabel, and in particular also
there will be a sun.
Maybe, I don't know. But the point is that the point is also that in other words, there doesn't have to be the whole concept of Shavirat HaKelem anymore. The tikkun will have been accomplished. Okay. I mean, there's plenty more we could talk about, but we also yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Continuing on Maisi Bereshis, Rav Asi pointed out another contradiction in the Pesukim. K'siv v'toter or desha b'tlach b'shamsa. On the third day of Maisi Bereshis, it says that the earth produced vegetation. Uchtiv, but then in the next paragraph it says v'chol siyah hasada terem yir ba'aretz, that none of the plants of the field were yet on the ground. So what is it? Did they come out of the ground or not? And that was b'malei shamsa. So that's on Friday. What is it? On the sixth day. So what is it? Were they created on the third day or were they created on the sixth? It means Malamad Shiyosu Deshoy. It means the grasses were created and they did come out. But Amdu al Pesach Karta. But they stayed by the entrance of the ground. In other words, they didn't actually sprout above ground yet. Ad Shaba Odomarishin Bikash Alem Rachmim, until Odomarishin came and davened for Rachmim, because as Rashi says on the Pesach, Odom realized the importance of rain to the world. So he had to daven for it. The Yoduk Shom and the Tzampu. And then rain fell, and then the plants were actually able to sprout. This is among many other things. This is the whole idea of Issarus Adel Asata and Issarus Adel Eva, that there couldn't be, in order for there to be growth, there has to be Issarus Adel Eva, but the Issarus Adel Eva itself has to be evoked by an Issarus Adel Asata by Adam Rishon davening.
For Rachamim.
For Rachamim, davening that there should be rain, right? So this teaches us that Hashem looks forward and Hashem desires the tefillah of tzaddikim, that Hashem, so to speak, the Hashem couldn't make the grasses grow until a tzaddik, Adam Rishon, stood there and davened for rain.
What about the Beinonim?
Tzaddikim Pashasvim means more generally. It could be a Beinonim. It could be in general the Jewish people, the Rabbicholim tzaddikim, whatever. Obviously, there's different levels. Okay. So here's an example. Rav Nachman Rav Papa Havilei Hahigitza. Rav Nachman Rav Papa had a garden. Shodi Be Bizani. He planted seeds in it. V'loy Tzamach, and they weren't growing. Bar Rachni. So he davened. Also Mitzra of a Tzamach, and then rain came, and when the seeds started sprouting. Omer. So he said, Tainer did Rav Asi. There was a perfect example of what Rav Asi is saying, that in order for things to grow, you need to be lost in Shal Tzadikim. That Hashem is looking forward to it, and until that, nothing is going to start happening. Okay. Getting back now to the animals that we mentioned before, we were talking before about the kosher and non-kosher animals in our Mishnah in the beginning of the Gemara. Almer of Chanan Bar Rava, Hashsua Beria B'fnei Atmahi, Now you have like this in Parshas, the list of kosher and non-kosher animals is two times in the Torah. You have it in Parshas Shemini, where it says that you can eat the animals that have the chew their cud and have split hooves, and these are the ones that have only one simen and you can't eat them. The camel, the shofron, the arneves, and the pig. Then it talks about the fish, and then it talks about the birds, etc. That whole thing with some variations is repeated again in Parshas Re'eh. But there are some variations, including that in Parshas Re'eh, it gives the actual list of kosher animals. But aside from that, also in Parshas Re'eh, when it starts by saying the following animals you can't eat, and it says it starts by saying you can't eat animals that have only one simen, and it uses the expression achas zeloy sofu, the following animals you shouldn't eat. Among the ones that chew their cud, and of the ones that have split hooves. Now, on the face of it, hashsua is part of the description of the hooves. Even though they have split hooves, the chazir, you're still not allowed to eat it. However, the Gemara's understanding over here that the word hashsua is actually the beginning of the list of animals. Hashsua is the name of a type of animal. It is a creature of its own.
Hashasua
is the name of a creature. Sheyesh la shnei gavin or shnei shadrois, that has two backs and two spines.
A camel just has one spine.
It has hump. The humps are lumps of fat. They're not actually part of the spine.
They contain water, don't they?
They contain fat, actually. They contain fat.
The fat burns.
Anyway, the point is, though, that so what do we mean by this? So the Gemara actually mentions in Nida, the Gemara mentions a machlokes between Rav and Shmuel. What do we mean by this? Are we talking about a different species of animal? And I mentioned yesterday or 2 days ago that Malbim says it might be an animal, he calls it tayasu, nowadays called a peccary, which is an animal that lives in South America. It's native to South America. It's like a pig. It has split hooves, doesn't chew its cud, and it has a deep groove down its back, which makes it look like it has two backs. So maybe that's what it's talking about.
What's it called?
Nowadays it's called a peccary. Okay, the Malbim calls it Tayasu, which I guess is the native name for it or whatever. Anyway, so that's one possibility. The other possibility, the Gemara mentions over there, is maybe the Shesua is conjoined twins, Siamese twins, an animal that was born, two animals that are born conjoined, that the Pasuk is telling us, even though they came from a kosher species, you're not allowed to eat them. Okay. Anyway, so that's what we're saying, Ashsua, very pronounced. The word Ashsua doesn't just mean describing the hooves that are split. It means the animal itself has a split. In other words, that either it's a Siamese twin or it's a species that has that has two backs or appears to have two backs or whatever. So the question is, was Moshe Rabbeinu a trapper or a trapper who traps, mm-hmm. Knigi means a trapper who traps, mm-hmm. wild animals, a blistery, or like the word ballistics in English, like somebody who can shoot arrows to catch animals. The question is, in other words, how does Moshe know of these animals that people aren't necessarily familiar with? The Shesua, for example, whether you say it's a separate species, which may not have existed in that part of the world at the time yet, or whether you say that Siamese twins, which aren't born very often, how does Moshe Rabbeinu know such things? The answer is Mikan Shuvala Omer in Torah Minashamayim. From here you have a proof to those who claim the Torah is not Minashamayim, that Moshe wrote it himself, because Moshe could not possibly have known such things. Must be Hashem knew them and dictated them to Moshe. Ovaler of Chista, Lord of Tachlifa Baravina. So, Rav Tachlif, this brisa, this statement that we just said, Knigi Hoya, Blisteri Hoya, Rav Chista tells Rav Tachlifa Baravina, Zilk Soiv, Knigi or Blisteri Bagadtech, write down the words Knigi and Blisteri in your Agadta. In other words, he had a book of Agadtas that he used when he's giving Joshua, or Parsha and explain it. So why should he do that? Rashi explains that we just had now a very nicely phrased statement. So Rav Chista wants Rav Tachlifa Bar Avina to use that nice wording, and this nice, clear, literary type wording when he gives the drasha. However, the average person who hears it is not going to know what knigi is, and is not going to know what blistery is. So therefore, he tells him, use those words in your drasha, but also explain what a knigi is and explain what a blistery is.
Knigi again.
A knigi is a trapper, somebody who knows to set traps. And a blisteri would be somebody who knows how to shoot arrows and catch them. Right, an archer, right. The Maral explains that that Rav Chista is telling Rav Tachlifa Bar Avina a little differently. He's telling him, in general, Chayav Adam Loima B'Loshin Rabbe, you're supposed to say a teaching of Torah in the same expression with which you heard it from your Rebbe. So therefore, you having heard this in this form, when you're giving drashas to the Tibur, you should use the same expression. But again, because they don't know what Knigi and Blistery is, make sure that you explain it to them. Okay. Another one, similarly, you have a problem.
Is somebody
can trap it. Yeah. Okay. Another example of such a thing, you have like this. A pasuk in Yoshua that says, Chamesha Saune Plishtim. The pasuk is mentioning over there the various parts of Eretz Yisrael that they didn't conquer in the times of Yoshua. They had conquered the 31 kings, etc., but there were still parts of Eretz Yisrael that they hadn't conquered. So it says, Chamesha Saune Plishtim, the five leaders of the five princes or dukes or whatever you want to call them of the Plishtim. Ha'azothi, the ones in Aza, v'ha'ashdoidi, v'ha'ashkeloni, ha'giti, v'ha'akroni, v'ha'adu. So the question is, it started out by saying Chamesha Saune Plishtim, but it lists six places, or six nations, or tribes, or whatever. So what is it? Amar Rabbi Yonasan, Arunki Shalahem Chamesha. So what it is Rabbi Yonasan says, the more important ones among them are five. In other words, it's true. Altogether there were six, but the Avim are not so important. So therefore, even though they were there, nevertheless, they're not called Chamesha Saune Plishtim because they're not the five chiefs.
The Avim were what?
The Avim were some other nation or some other part of the Plishtim. We're going to see in a second who they were. Anyway, so the point is, so that's how it is, five or six. So therefore, similarly, Omelet of Chista, Rav Tachlifa Bar Avina, so the same thing. Rav Chista says to Rav Tachlifa Bar Avina, Ksoiv Arumki Vagadtech. Again, write down in your book of Agadtech this word Arumki, so that when you're giving over this drosha, you can use that word. Or Parsha, but also explain it, because the average person doesn't know what Arumki means, that it means the important ones. Okay. And the Gemara points out, Upsliga Derav. Now, this explanation that the Avim are part of the Plishtim, they're just a less important part, that disagrees with Rav's explanation of that same passage. The Omer Rav, Avim Mitemon Bov. Because Rav says that actually the Avim are not part of the Plishtim at all, rather they came from Tamon. Now nowadays Tamon means Yemen. There it doesn't, but not necessarily doesn't mean Tamon. The pastures, it means some part of Eretz Yisrael. But the point is, in the Psukim over there you have like this. It mentions the Chamesha Saune Plishtim. It gives a list. The Pasuk finishes off for Avim, and then it continues Mitamon Kol Eretz Aknan. So the simple meaning is, in other words, it's same. It means Mitamon Kol Eretz Aknan. The simple meaning of the Pasuk is that it means from the south, you have the remaining land of the Canaanim that wasn't conquered on the south side of Eretz Yisrael. But Rav is explaining the word Mitamon goes with the word Ha'avim from the end of the previous pasuk. Now the pasuk is saying you have the five Saune Plishtim, and then by the way you also have the Ha'avim Mitamon, the Avim who came from Tamon and lived in that area. So according to him, they're not part of the Plishtim at all. Kaninami Hachi, we learn like that in the Braita as well, as opposed to the other explanation that they were part of the Plishtim but a less important part. Okay, Tanya Nami Hochi, Avim Mitamon Bo, another, the Braita says similarly, the Avim came from Tamon, from the south. In many places, Tamon is a part of Edom, so maybe that's what it means here also.
Tamon is a part of Edom.
Now, again, in modern usage, Tamon means Yemen, but not necessarily doesn't mean that in the Pesukim. Okay, Veloma Nikra Shmom Avim, so why are they called Avim?
So it makes a hard say?
Maybe. V'loma nikra shmon avim, so why are they called avim? She'ivsu es mekoyman, because they avim means to make crooked or to destroy. Yeah, Rashi says mekeyman, ben esav. You have the psukim in Parshas Vayishlach mentioned that Eliphaz had a son named Tamon, the bnei Eliphaz, yeah, not in Kaisar, in Vayishlach. Tamon, Omer, Tzvay, etc. So, yeah. So these people, according to this explanation, are descended from Tamon. They left their place and they went to live among the Plishtim. So she evu es makoyman that they made their place crooked. In other words, they left their area where they used to live in Edom, and it was destroyed after they left. So therefore, they're called avim. Davar achar avim she evu lo lekoyman. Evsu means corrupted or destroyed. Rashi says yotsu misham v'nis aves shechara. They left that place and it became crooked in the sense that where they lived was left desolate and destroyed. Yeah. So that's one reason they're called Avim. Avim Another reason they're called Avim is because they desired many gods, and therefore Avim and Ivu are Taiva. It's in Lashon Taiva, right? I mean, it's like one's an Aleph and one's an Ayin, but you often find the Joshua that Aleph and Ayin are interchanged. Gavracha, another explanation, they're called Avim, Shekolo Roya Oysem Oichazos Le Avis, because they're so powerful that anybody who sees them gets cramps. They're so fearful, like they get so nervous and shaky that they develop cramps from seeing them. Rabbi Yosef says, you want to know how powerful they are? They have 16, each one of them has 16 rows of teeth. The pashtus, it doesn't mean literally nobody has 16 rows of teeth. The pashtus, it's a way of expressing how powerful they are. Maybe, no, well, most people have 32 teeth. But maybe,
well,
okay.
One.
Whatever what it means, they have extra powerful teeth. It means they have extra powerful weaponry, whatever it means exactly. Yeah. Okay. Have you davened Myra already? Okay, so then I guess we better stop here. Okay, so we have a little more to talk about the Avim tomorrow, and then we'll continue from there. That's the Shem.
Between me and Mari?
That's the Shem.
What time?